Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Very happy to have you along with us today as we take a look at what went on politically last week. Our guests are Kathleen Dolan, who is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the UW-Milwaukee, and our second guest is Tom Yantek, who is an associate professor and director of undergraduate studies in the Department of Political Science at Kent State University. And Kathy Dolan, you're with us on the guest line, I believe. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Pleasure to have you with us. And we're attempting to link up with Tom Yantek. Expect to have him with us shortly. The big thing, I suppose, this weekend was the events that went on in Des Moines. Did you have a chance to go?
In Des Moines?
Yes.
No, I'm in Wisconsin.
No, I'm just saying that maybe you had gone to Des Moines to see what was going on with the event there.
No, I was not there.
So most of the headlines seem to be about Senator Clinton and Senator Obama and their weekend of skirmishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's coming to sort of crunch time for the candidates, and one of the challenges for Democratic candidates whose name is not Clinton is that she's been the front runner, you know, sort of nationally. She's really developing this front runner reputation, and they really have to figure out how to sort of stop her momentum if they are going to have any traction in Iowa. And so I think that, you know, we're going to start seeing more of a pattern of the other Democratic candidates being very pointed toward her, and, you know, in that attempt to try to get some news to themselves.
What do you think about this, the idea that these candidates are piling on Senator Clinton? Isn't it necessary if they're going to move up in the standings or gain more votes, they're going to have to chip away at her lead?
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. And I would say that I guess I feel as if this notion of piling on, I would say that this is as much, if not more, about the fact that she is the perceived front runner than it is about her sex. If you remember after the Democratic debate a couple of weeks ago, when much of the time was spent with the other candidates sort of attacking her,
mm-hmm.
In the press over the couple of days after that, there was some sense of, you know, oh, is this the men beating up on the woman and that sort of thing. But I think that we would see this same pattern regardless of who the front runner was. And as I said, you know, we're within 60 days of the caucuses beginning now. And if, particularly Obama and Edwards, if they're going to do well, they both want to win Iowa. For either of them, coming in second or third isn't necessarily going to be good enough. And so I think that they all have to start turning their attention to figuring out ways to slow her, because if she wins Iowa and then moves into New Hampshire and does well in New Hampshire, then the primary process is going to unfold pretty quickly.
We're now joined by Tom Yantek. Thanks very much for joining us, Tom.
Nice to be here.
You're an associate professor and director of undergraduate studies at the Department of Political Science at Kent State University. And what are your observations after the weekend Jefferson-Jackson dinner in Iowa?
Oh, pretty much business as usual. Mm-hmm. I agree with the comments that were just made. This is nothing that we haven't seen in virtually every election cycle, delegates election cycle, to be more accurate, previously. And I don't think it, I mean, I understand from Senator Clinton's perspective why she might want to carve out a unique angle to provide herself a little more traction, but I don't think this is anything that we haven't seen for every other front runner in the modern system of electioneering.
Mm-hmm. Now, Senator Obama maintains that Senator Clinton is running a poll-driven campaign that avoids tough questions. Do you see that? Do you sense that?
Absolutely. Why wouldn't the front runner do that? It's not necessarily the best policy that we as members of the electorate might want, but from the candidate's perspective, it certainly makes a lot of sense. And you have to keep in mind that we're talking about the wife of the person who invented, along with Dick Morris, the process of triangulation, and that was so successful for the Clinton administration that it's no surprise that Senator Clinton, in this case, would probably try to adopt some of those same strategies.
If you'd like to join this conversation with Professors Kathleen Dolan and Tom Yantek, then join us by calling 1-800-642-1234. If you are in the Madison area, the local number is 263-1890. As we do each Monday morning, take a look at all things political, what happened during the last week, and we're curious about what your thoughts are and what your questions are. I noticed that Senator Clinton is trying to defuse things with her strongest candidates, Mr. Obama, Mr. Edwards, by urging Democrats to refrain from attacking one another and instead turning up the heat on the Republicans. That's, I suppose, the strategy that she needs to develop then in an attempt to get the bullseye off her back. Is that true, Kathleen?
Well, it is certainly a strategy that serves her interests as a candidate and as the front runner. But I think it also is a strategy that she, you know, might be suggesting is going to help the party as well. Because one of the problems with a primary is that if candidates who share a party label spend some period of time trying to trash and destroy each other, whoever survives looks lesser for it. And so at some level, while it certainly serves her purposes to not be the target, I think at some level, if she and the other two spend, you know, the next 2 months really making each other look foolish and bloody and incompetent and not worthy to hold office, then you've got people out in the electorate, independents or people who might be weakly affiliated with the party, saying, here's some damaged goods. Really, where's the leadership? What, you know, what do I want with that person? So parties themselves always run the risk when there are these inter-party squabbles of the candidate who comes out of the end looking weaker than they could. So I think she might be, you know, trying to call for that unity, saying, hey, look, the problems here are really with the Republicans and with President Bush. We all have perhaps differing visions of how we want to move the country forward, but that's what we're reacting against, as opposed to, you know, really focusing on their differences from each other.
Mm-hmm. Let's take some calls, and we'll start off with Brandy in Lake Mills. Brandy, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I have a question for the professors about the primaries themselves. Why is it that all of the results have to be released after the primary elections? Couldn't they hold the vote tallies until more states have had their primaries so that's not such a big effect on the campaign trail? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Kathleen, would you go ahead?
Sure. You know, that notion of having people vote and not having an a result released until some period of time would be completely foreign to our sort of modern political culture. We see a process this year where states are moving their primaries forward and trying to piggy jump or leapfrog over each other to be first and be early as possible. But I really can't envision a scenario in which we would get states to adopt those sorts of things. You know, election laws are information, they're news, they're of public record. I can't imagine the media would sit back for that. I can't imagine the candidates would, that the voters would. So the question is whether we can bring some greater sense of order to this process of primary elections, or whether we're simply moving in the direction of doing a national primary and or caucus function at some point in the future.
If you'd like to join the conversation, again, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Jim Packard sitting in for Kathleen Dunn this morning. Our guest, Kathleen Dolan, who is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the UW-Milwaukee. And we're going to get back Tom Yantek, associate professor and director of undergraduate studies at the Department of Political Science, Kent State University. In the Wall Street Journal this past Thursday, the latest Wall Street Journal NBC News poll indicated that Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani are in a sort of a tie, a dead heat in terms of matching them up.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm not sure how much stock I put in the head-to-head polls at this point. You know, the national polls do seem to suggest that Hillary Clinton is the front runner on the Democratic side, and the same for Rudy Giuliani on the Republican side. But you'll remember that 4 years ago, at this point in the process, Howard Dean was considered to be the runaway favorite. So personally, you know, until votes are cast and until this process gets in play, we have to remember that national polls are simply that. They're just a test of what people are sort of feeling nationally, and they don't necessarily have much relation to where individual candidates are doing within any particular state. So having said that, then the usefulness of those head-to-head polls, you know, if Clinton were running against Giuliani, given that both of those are such hypotheticals at this point, I think you're just simply, you know, measuring people's reactions to those two people at this point in the process. But faced with that voter choice down the road, I don't know that what people's reactions are today really matches what they would be if those two were the nominees and we're talking, you know, next September, October, something like that.
In this same Wall Street Journal, NBC News poll of last week, among Americans overall, the poll indicated 24% said the country isn't ready to elect a woman president. Mm-hmm. 69% said the country is ready.
Mm-hmm.
That square with your understanding of the situation?
Well, if that's what the polls are, then, you know, that's sort of our understanding of the situation at this point. Again, those sorts of things, particularly with regard to the questions when we are asking people, are we ready to elect an African-American? Are we ready to elect a woman? Are we ready to elect a Hispanic? There is going to be there's going to be some number of people who respond in a socially desirable fashion, you know, in that we don't want to appear sexist, we don't want to appear racist. And so that 69% of the country says we're ready is, again, simply what people are responding to pollsters. Does that mean that, you know, those figures are accurate? We don't know. We can't say. It's really hard to determine how much people are articulating what they think pollsters want to hear or what they think they should say. And, you know, quite frankly, it's also the sort of thing where respondents have no knowledge base, right?
Mm-hmm.
My sense that the public is ready to elect a woman or not is nothing more than my opinion. I don't know. I don't have any real information.
Right.
You know, I can say, oh, you know, given the people I know, would we vote for her or not? But that has absolutely nothing, you know, that's valid in a country of 300 million people with as much diversity as we have politically and economically. And
well, let's
socially.
Look at the Republicans, Tom Yantek. Mr. Giuliani, supposedly in this Wall Street Journal, NBC News poll, leads all of the Republican candidates by a margin of at least 2-1. Senator John McCain of Arizona running second behind him, and that Fred Thompson has slipped since he's announced his candidacy. Your reaction to that poll?
I didn't hear you mention Romney. Where was he in that poll?
Romney stuck in fourth place.
Really?
Yes. at 11% nationally.
Well, I'm not sure what the logistics of this particular poll were, but I think that has something to do with his being a relatively new person on the block. Overall, it's an interesting poll result, and it bears somewhat on the comments that Professor Dolan just made, because these are national polls, and one of the things we know about the way that the nominees are selected is they're selected on a state-by-state basis. And furthermore, a critical distinction is one that we make between the general electorate and the primary electorate. And the people who respond to polls nationally, most of them will not even participate in the nomination stage, so they won't be showing up at caucuses. They won't be they won't be showing up to vote during a primary election. We know that the electorate who helps select the Republican nominee is generally going to be much more conservative than the population as a whole, just as the electorate that will help select the Democratic nominees are much more liberal than the population as a whole. So to say that Rudy Giuliani enjoys whatever percent, 37% of the national Republican Party support isn't necessarily the same thing as saying that he therefore is going to get 37% of the vote in the primary electorate.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it might configure very differently once people actually have to show up.
Right. Well, let's take some more calls and get the feeling of the public. And let's go to Kathy in Waupaca. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
There was a major vote in the Senate last week, obviously, on confirming Mukasey as Attorney General. And I am thoroughly disgusted with four Democrats and the one Republican senator who were running for president. Not a one of them voted because they were too busy campaigning. Do you get, if you run for president, do you get automatically get 2 years passed that you don't have to vote anymore in the Senate? That's That's disgusting.
Well, no, that's not the situation. But what we're seeing is candidates balancing their traveling for their presidential campaign with their obligations and duties in the Senate. And the key issues here, and this is in part what some people find distasteful, is that a lot of the campaigning at this point is about fundraising. And so presidential candidates who have to raise, you know, on the order of millions of dollars a week to be successful find that they have to be in places physically that are not Washington, D.C. to be effective fundraisers. There was a study out, roll call, the newspaper on Capitol Hill had done an analysis recently that said that Senator Obama has missed about 80% of the votes in the last, 6 months or something. I can't remember what the time frame was. And so of all the candidates, he was the one who was missing the most, and then they sort of ranked them. And so this is a problem, right? I mean, one of the things that came out of the debate was a particular situation when Senator Obama was criticizing Senator Clinton for a vote she'd made recently, except it didn't come out that he'd not voted on that issue. And so candidates can be strategic if they want to miss certain votes, and they can say, I didn't take a vote on that, I didn't have a position, which they then don't have to defend necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have to balance their commitments to being in Iowa and New Hampshire as often as they can, and fundraising, with their role in the Senate. And that is certainly for individual voters to evaluate whether they find the sort of abdication of the current duties to be offensive. Then that's certainly something people will consider. I think presidential candidates who are sitting elected officials would suggest that there's really not much else they can do if they're going to be viable. People like Governor Mike Huckabee, former Governor Mike Huckabee, he doesn't have a day job other than running for president right now. He can run all around the country. But it's not necessarily the same situation for sitting office holders.
Tom Jantek, your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with everything that was just said. One of the things that we as a people actually haven't really come to grips with, I think, is the desire as individual residents of states that figure prominently in the early stages of the nomination process. We demand to see them, the candidates, in person, pressing the flesh. That's why Iowa and New Hampshire retain their status, despite the fact that they're so non-representative of the rest of the country in many demographic ways. We want candidates to get out and show their faces. At the same time, we expect that they should still be doing their jobs responsibly, which means casting votes. And frankly, you can't have it both ways necessarily. You can't be in Washington and in Nashua or Des Moines at the same time. And again, I think it's just a sign of an electorate that wants it all and doesn't think through the implications, and also, frankly, of an elections process that has gotten so protracted that it's almost become ridiculous.
Our guests are Professor Kathleen Dolan of the Department of Political Science at the UW-Milwaukee. Tom Jantek is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Kent State University. And we have a line or two open if you'd like to get your call in this morning at 263-1890 in Madison or 1-800-642-1234 as we talk about all things political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about all things political here on the Ideas Network, and glad to have you with us today, our guests Kathleen Dolan and Tom Jantek. And let's go next to Dan in Franksville. Dan, what's on your mind today?
My mind is, I think that what I actually do during so-called election time is rubber stamp who's already been picked, because I believe that mainstream media is basically censored, maybe even worse than old Pravda of Russia, that media, but because they decide right from the beginning, they worked off the money issue that this one's, Obama's collecting this much money, Hillary's collecting this much money, and all of a sudden, those people are the front runners. There hasn't hardly even been a debate or anything. These are the front runners, and all of a sudden, the next thing that's all that's talked about is those two people. There's other people that are running, but they're basically, they're not even there because the media doesn't, there's no exposure to them. So the public listens, and they think those people are irrelevant. So we go to election time, we rubber stamp who money's already picked, and they call that democracy.
Kathleen?
Well, I would suggest that the media are not censored by any means in our country, but I will say that the media present politics in a particular way, and that is often a way that is easiest for reporters to report and easiest for people to consume, and that is to do exactly what the caller is suggesting by presenting numbers and facts and figures and what we in political science call the horse race. You know, Hillary Clinton raised X number of dollars. Barack Obama raised Y number of dollars. Those sorts of things are not in dispute. They are easy to understand. They are easy to print and to analyze. But they don't necessarily get at a lot of the things that I think the caller is wanting to hear and learn about candidates. And so I think you could rightly take issue with the way that the media present politics in the United States. I also think that, you know, Tom used the phrase, you know, a system that's almost out of control to the point of ridiculousness. And I think he's absolutely right in that, you know, we do have a situation in which if you're seen as strong at the beginning, then you're strong. And once you're strong, you're seen as strong. And there is a snowball effect. And that's why it's very hard for the people we call second-tier candidates to get heard and to make an impact. People don't want to sit and listen and talk. And newspaper reporters are not about writing in-depth stories that, you know, lay out people's entire platforms. And for people to be fully informed on those sorts of things, they would have to be watching all of the debates that are going on television, which have problems of their own.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have, in many ways, because the public is only so sort of interested and capable of following politics for so long, and because the media present things in a certain way, we do have a pretty oversimplified and sort of, you know, encapsulized sense of what's important in the race. And whether it serves democracy well or not is certainly a question you can ask.
There's a story in the New York Times this morning about interest groups and their money jumping into the race. They mentioned the newly formed Foundation for a Secure and Prosperous America, which is running television commercials in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see this as the first wave of the sort of swift boat kind of ads that we saw 4 years ago?
Well, you know, the beauty of our system is that every time we try to regulate campaign finance, spending and funding, people find ways around it. So in the last presidential election, we saw the growth of the 529 groups that were all doing independent expenditures. There will be other of those same sorts of groups this time. And these are things that are not just at the presidential level, because if you think about the recent West Bend school referendum, there was a national organization called Americans for Prosperity who funded just dozens and dozens and dozens of robocalls to voters in the local school district about a local referenda trying to convince people to vote against it.
Mm-hmm.
So these sorts of outside influences, these independent expenditures, happen at every level of our politics. Candidates generally are very opposed to these sorts of things because they get in the way of the message the candidate wants to send. But in our system, where money is seen as a form of political speech, and we have more openness in our system, this is sort of the natural result of people figuring out a way to work that system.
Professor Yantek, let's ask about following through on this, whether or not Senator McCain would welcome this kind of support that that these people would be giving to a position that he would agree with.
Candidates have a very tricky path to follow when these things happen. Generally, of course, any kind of free advertising is good advertising if you're going to accept some of the restrictions that are made available. If you accept matching funds from the Federal Election Commission, then you're going to want to supplement your campaign expenditures any way you can, and free media, therefore, is all important. The thing that candidates worry about incessantly, though, and their organizations worry about all the time, is that some of these independent groups will go so far off the reservation that they can actually cause a backlash against the candidacy. We've seen examples of that in the past. The example of the Swift boat veterans makes you wonder, though, how far off reservation you have to get now in order to be truly off reservation. So I agree with your point that candidates like to get this kind of free exposure, but they also it can be a double-edged sword, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Let's go to Scott next in Green Bay. Scott, what can we do for you?
Well, good morning. I guess I just wanted to continue with the conversation you're having. And it seems like the way we elect presidents is just somewhat becoming more and more bizarre. The campaigns are starting quite a bit earlier than they had in the past, and it seems to become politics of celebrity. And I'm going to use Hillary Clinton for an example, but I'm not trying to pick on her, but she's the best example. What she's known for is being Bill's wife. I mean, she's the front runner. I don't know how she became the front runner, but she is the front runner because it's become politics of celebrity. She's a one-term senator, and there's not a lot of accomplishments she can point to, but she, out of the box, became the Democrats' choice, and then the media's choice for the Democratic nomination. And I'm just wondering how we move to becoming more serious about politics. And same thing with the debates. I mean, except for the last debate, these debates have been infomercials for the candidates more than anything else. Mm-hmm.
Tom, do you want to pick up on that?
It's a really good point. I don't necessarily disagree with it. I would just offer from a sort of, not to get too preachy or teachy on a Monday morning, but rules do have consequences, and one of the consequences of the rules that we operate under to nominate our candidates is that essentially advantages candidates with name recognition and or large piles of cash. The system now is so front-loaded, and this has become more and more true with each successive election cycle since 1976, the first time that we ran under this new, well, 72 was really the first time we ran under the new rules, but then 76, of course, became an example for all subsequent generations, where Jimmy Carter was able to go from a poll rating of about 2% nationally in January of the election year and still get the nomination because the system was more drawn out. Today, we know that on February 5th, I believe it is, about 20 states with about half, more than half, I think, of all the delegates will have their nominating contest. That gives a tremendous advantage to people like Hillary Clinton or Rudy Giuliani or anyone else who has a fairly prominent name, and it disadvantages people like Ron Paul or even Chris Dodd or Joe Biden, who are very well-respected members of the Senate, but haven't figured prominently in the headlines. And it's a problem that we have to, at some point, wrestle with. The parties have tried to. There are some potential punishments that will be handed over to some of the states this year that have jumped ahead of where the rules said they ought to be. We'll see if those rules actually get enforced once we move to the conventions, though. If they don't, it's just a further sign that candidates are free to do what they want and to move things up as much as they want.
Kathleen, let's talk about Ron Paul for a moment. He had a wonderful week in that friends or supporters of his set up a website called thisnovember5th.com, took in more than $4 million online and another $200,000 over the phone, a record among this year's Republican candidates. He seems to be getting stronger. His message seems to be stronger. And there's some talk that he could influence the outcome in New Hampshire.
Well, and there's also some talk that he might run as a third-party candidate, because we all know he's not going to get the nomination. I think his candidacy is an interesting example of how the phenomenon of internet politics can affect things, because he never could have raised that much money without the exposure that he's had in the debates and then using the internet tools to raise all that money. So he's a good example of how, you know, the sort of contemporary mechanics of politics can have an impact on things. The other thing is that, you know, at this point he has been allowed into the debates, where, you know, another issue that we will see as the process moves along is that, you know, to be considered viable by the media and to be invited into these debates, you have to meet their criteria. So on the Democratic side, Mike Gravel has been excluded from a couple of the recent debates because he doesn't poll nationally. He doesn't, you know, fit the criteria that the media have established. So this notion of truncation and this notion of focusing on a handful of people who we see as viable from the beginning is absolutely true. And the downside is we don't really see, or at least it doesn't seem clear, how we can really put the brakes on things. You know, we will never go back to the political culture we were 30 years ago. So how do we stop what seems like the inevitable sort of crash and craziness of this process?
We're talking with Kathleen Dolan, who is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the UW-Milwaukee, and Tom Yantek, an associate professor, director of undergraduate studies in the Department of Political Science at Kent State University, talking about all things political, the things that happened last week. And if you'd like to join in, the number in Madison, 263-1890. Anywhere else, 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Wayne in Appleton next. Hello, Wayne.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, my question is somewhat related to a previous caller's question about the so-called popularity polling and front runners. I am concerned that two of the front runners in the Democratic Party at least do not have what we normally consider to be executive experience and managing businesses or managing the state governments. So I'd appreciate their comments on that.
All right. Tom, you want to start off?
It wouldn't be unprecedented if we were to elect a president who didn't have executive experience. Of course, in recent election cycles, we do seem to have gravitated that way. It may be that there are candidates who have been able to demonstrate their skills in other capacities. Certainly being a senator in the United States Congress is not, you know, it's not chopped liver, as they say. It may not be the same thing as running a state or running a large business, but it is something that gives you a consistent role in policy making in the United States. And so I think we have to, you know, be careful about how closely we might draw our requirements.
Mm-hmm. Kathleen, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would say that the notion that there is a particular path of experience is not one that our history has really played out. You can take what you will, and people certainly have a range of positions on President Bush, more of them negative these days than positive, but that he was governor of Texas did not necessarily give him the tools to make him a successful president, by any number of measures. So governor is not analogous to president. There is no analogous position. It is a political position as much as it is a governmental position. It is not a position in which the president is completely in power and gets to make all the decisions he or she wants. I also sort of personally chafe against the business model. Mitt Romney is staking a lot of his claim on the fact that he was a CEO and a governor, blah, blah, blah. Government is not a business. I mean, the president does not get to do whatever he or she wants. They have, you know, another set of institutions that they share power with. They have political concerns. So I'm not sure that there is a position or an experience or a body of skills that is the absolute best for the presidency, in part because the presidency is such a personal office. You know, there are a set of powers, and then the person who inherits that office will use and interpret them in their own personal way. And so I think we can look at successful presidents who've had certain experiences, and we can look at unsuccessful presidents who may have had the same sort of experience. And so I think, as Tom said, I think we want to be careful of saying that there is a preferred path to the presidency or a preferred set of experiences that make somebody better or less well-suited.
Thanks very much for the question. Kathleen Dolan, Tom Yantek, our guests as we talk about all things political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. Hope your Monday is off to a good start. Let's go to Dorothy next in Madison. Dorothy, what can we do for you?
Well, good morning. I agree with most everything that people have said, but I am old and I don't understand why we don't have a national primary that all the states vote at the same time. I also do not understand why we can't, all the states can't have one ballot, one way of voting for president. And I think money is, I mean, I never heard money talk. My money doesn't talk to me. So I don't understand where the Supreme Court came up with that idea. And that's about it.
All right, Dorothy. Kathy, you want to, or Kathleen, you want to take a response to that?
Sure. The primary arguments against a national primary, and these were more relevant in the past than they're going to sound today, is that by doing things on a 50-state basis and by doing them over some period of time, you know, we have to remember that, that states will have their primaries from January almost through the end of May. And so the primary season, as it will occur in the 50 states, is actually a much longer season than we focus on, because the truncated notion of the presidential process is that those first early states often determine the winner. So we used to say that the reason to do it this way, to have 50 different primary contests, is to give the public time to get to know the candidates, get exposed to all of them, give the candidates time to make their case and make their arguments. And the 50-state system was really, in some ways, intended to allow somebody like Jimmy Carter to come from way back in the pack and convince people that he was the best one. So part of the problem with national primaries or a national primary would be that people would see it as a further truncation of this process, and the campaign itself would start, you know, two full years early, because we'd have to do all of that exposure and learning ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
Just to briefly answer the question why states do their elections differently, which I assume is a reference back to 2000 and the problems where states were using different kinds of ballots and things like that, is that one of the other things we don't focus on in presidential politics sometimes is that states are very important in the elections process in the United States. The United States Constitution mandates very little about how elections are run, and instead really gives a lot of that legal power to states, and that's one of the ways in which the state and national governments work together. So states run elections in the United States under the umbrella of some rules set up by the national government, but state legislatures and, you know, state boards of elections make their own decisions about how they're going to run elections and what kinds of ballots they're going to use and where they're going to put the polling places and, you know, all those different sorts of things. So there may be better equipment, there may be, you know, better ways to do things. We can talk about voter registration. But states in the United States are very powerful politically, and they have an important role to play in elections, and those things matter, and they have consequences, as Tom said. I mean, we're so focused on Iowa and New Hampshire simply because Iowa and New Hampshire have historically been the first states to go. But mm-hmm. there are no rules, there are no laws that say, you know, national laws that say that this must be the process. This is tradition. But we have empowered states pretty dramatically in this way.
Tom, let me ask you about those states that are defying the political parties, the national political parties, by moving their dates of their primaries, and as a result may have some problems getting credentialed at the national.
Yes, this is going to be a really interesting question for political scientists to watch. One of the key distinctions that I think a lot of people lose sight of, Kathleen very rightly pointed to the role that the states exercise under the Constitution, but another important distinction is that between the national political parties and the states, because really you have two sources of authority in this entire process. And the Supreme Court has been very clear in recognizing the two national parties, the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee, as what they are. They are, in fact, private entities. We don't think of them that way because they're so centrally involved in our elections processes at all levels, but they are actually private organizations, and therefore they have rights of free assembly and association under the Constitution. What that means is that they can hold their national conventions and they can invite or disinvite, if you will, anyone whom they choose to invite or disinvite. That's what empowers them to tell a Michigan or a Florida that if you hold your nominating contest, your primary or your caucus, too early, we will exclude your delegates. And they're allowed to do that because, again, under the First Amendment, they're privileged to do that. What it means, though, is that you have this never-ending dance between 50 different state parties and 50 different state legislatures, all of whom are trying to exact their own advantage out of the system. It's a tremendously, wonderfully interesting process if you're a political scientist, but I can imagine that if you're a candidate or more likely just a member of the electorate, it can probably be very frustrating trying to figure it out and to understand why they do things the way they do when almost any other system might seem more commonsensical.
Tom Jantek, Kathleen Dolan, our guests, and we'll take some more calls, including Steve in Rice Lake. Steve, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I picked up the phone right after Kathleen Dolan said that we already know that Ron Paul will not be the Republican candidate. An earlier caller had mentioned that the media plays an interesting role in shaping and defining and diminishing our choices, and I think that she is making herself part of that process. Simply by saying that Ron Paul will not be the candidate, that's something we hear from many media, although he may be expressing many of the points most important to the electorate.
Kathleen?
Well, I'm speaking from a factual basis, right? I mean, Ron Paul will not be the nominee. He does not have traction in Iowa. He does not have traction in New Hampshire. He does not have traction in any of the states that are early in the process. He's polling in very small numbers. I'm not defending the process by saying that, and I don't think that I'm contributing to it. I think if you rationally look at the landscape, the ability to win the nominating process is in the hands of a relatively small number of people. Whether this is a good or bad thing is a separate question, and you could certainly take either side of that question and make rational arguments. But observing what's going to happen and observing the way these things work, it's a pretty fair bet, right, that he's not going to get the nomination.
Thanks very much, Steve, for the call and for the comment. Let's talk about some of the other candidates. Let's talk about Mike Huckabee, who seems to be on the way up in his attempt to capture the nomination. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts about Mike Huckabee?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have long thought that Mike Huckabee is, from the perspective of the Republicans, the most sort of dangerous candidate, and by that I mean he's the one who could be the sleeper of this cycle. He is very conservative, right? I mean, lots of people in the Republican Party are sort of curious at some level about why he's not doing better, particularly among conservative voters. And again, part of it is that his lack of visibility and his lack of fundraising ability. And again, I'm not going to suggest that those things are right. I'm simply suggesting that they are. But he's moving up in the polls in Iowa. If he were to place third or second in the Iowa caucuses, that would be an enormous boost to his campaign. One of the things that we know about this process is that it snowballs. So whoever does well in Iowa will gain media attention. Their fundraising will tick up. They're going to go into New Hampshire with enhanced media presence. People will, you know, sort of focus on them. So if he does well in Iowa, it could really raise his chances. And if he does well, that means somebody else doesn't do as well. And Iowa and New Hampshire, those early primaries, are as much about people who underperform as it is people who do well. So if Mike Huckabee finishes in the top three, that means that one of the other assumed frontrunners does not, and that will, you know, say something about their campaigns. And so it certainly could give him a boost. Or it could be the sort of thing where he gets some renewed attention and people like what they see, and perhaps that strengthens him as a vice presidential selection, for whoever the ultimate nominee is. But it's going to be a question for somebody like him, if they do well very early, can they capitalize on that? Can they raise enough money quickly? Can they really turn it into enough attention where people say, oh, we hadn't really considered him, let's stop and take a new look?
John McCain, at a news conference in Iowa, said, every once in a while, I'm left speechless. This is one of those times. He was referring to Pat Roberts' endorsement of Rudy Giuliani. Tom Jantek, was that a surprise to you?
Well, I guess McCain stole my line. I'm kind of speechless, so I suppose I have to answer. If anyone claims that they weren't surprised by that nomination, I think he or she is being a little bit disingenuous. Yeah, that was a pretty big surprise, probably to the Giuliani camp more than anyone. I'm not sure where that came from other than to say that Pat Robertson has always been, along with whatever his role in the so-called, you know, private sector is, he's always been a fairly calculating politician. And if, you know, he reads poll results like anyone else to indicate that Giuliani may be the odds-on favorite, then perhaps he wants to get in early, just like you know, governors around the state, around the country, who endorse candidates early, want to get in their bids for favorable consideration later. Robertson may have some kind of ulterior motive in mind. I don't know. I wouldn't want to besmirch his motivations by any means, but it was a surprise, certainly.
Kathleen, Fred Thompson, who is positioning himself as the only true conservative candidate with a 100% voting record against abortion, mm-hmm. has yet to receive a significant endorsement from the evangelical community.
Mm-hmm.
Does that surprise you?
No, because he's not an evangelical candidate. I mean, Fred Thompson is a really interesting candidate, and Fred Thompson, I think, is emblematic of some of the problems in the system. You know, one of the callers referred to the notion of celebrity candidates, and Fred Thompson has not much other than his celebrity. I mean, he was in the Senate for a period of time, but his record was very thin. You know, people know him much more from his television and movie roles. So it's almost as if his candidacy was a function of people feeling there was a vacuum and, you know, there was this role that needed to be filled, and I don't mean to sound ironic by that, but and that he was the person to fill it. And he's sort of a really good example of him. His candidacy seemed to be much more popular before he announced. And since he announced, he, you know, has not shown himself to be the strong, dynamic candidate that people expected. And there's also been, you know, a fair amount of attention to his own religiosity and his own beliefs, and he is much more sort of guarded about it, much more private about it, which, again, I'm not suggesting is a bad thing or a good or bad thing. It's just what is. And so for evangelical candidates looking to know more about that aspect of a candidate, there's not as much to know or see there, I think, from him than from some of the others.
Mm-hmm. Tom Jantek, Bernie Kerik, let's talk about his role in the political process. Do you expect that he will be influential, or will he just be a sort of a byproduct of what's going on?
I'm sorry, who?
Bernie Kerik, the former New York police commissioner.
And well, certainly the media picked up on that right away. I want to get back indirectly to a point that Kathleen made earlier, mm-hmm. a very telling point. That is, the media have certain conventions that they follow, and because they're following this process for such a long time, if you've been on the bus with the Giuliani camp or the McCain camp for months and months and months, you've heard the same stump speech over and over and over. What you seek out, simply to keep your sanity in part, is some kind of novelty, some kind of innovation in the process, and Kerik provides something like that. Whether there is any implication here other than a bit of, you know, questioning of judgment, perhaps, about Giuliani's capacity to lead because he happens to have been involved in some business dealings with Kerik, who now is under investigation, of course. That remains to be seen. It certainly, as I said, provided something of a relief, I think, for a number of journalists who had something new, what they consider a fresh angle on something other than simply reporting the same canned responses at the same debates and, you know, candidate forums around the various states.
Let's take one more call from Steve in Menominee. Steve, what's on your mind?
Yeah, a couple of things. I don't know how many years ago, but parties changed their rules for nomination. Used to be a two-thirds majority was required of delegates to a convention for nomination. And then, of course, primaries, they went, some of them, from proportional delegates awarded to how many votes you got to winner-take-all. And I think both of those, if they were restored to what it was, then it would be more of a contest. There would be less of a need for states to push their primaries so front-loaded as it is becoming. And, of course, the conventions then, years ago, they used to have to come together. They'd have to make compromises. Candidates and their groups would have to work more together. Promises would need to be made in order to get the coalition to get the nomination, and it was just a more pulling together of the parties. They've lost all that.
Kathleen?
Well, you know, the caller's point, again, shows us the power of states and state election laws and the parties within the states. And you know, Tom made the very important point that the states and the parties are working together. But this notion of having elections at the state level where delegates are parceled out in a proportional system versus a winner-take-all. You know, the proportional representation system is in the contemporary politics in America not a very common system at all. And so the winner-take-all focus serves the interests of certain political interests at, you know, at any given time. And so I think there's a lot of momentum in that favor. Absolutely, that a different set of practices could result in different outcomes. But it again shows us, as you know, Tom made the important point, that rules have consequences and decisions and choices have consequences. And the system we have now and what we're experiencing is predicated on those rules and decisions. If we change them, right, which we could, we have the certainly, you know, states, parties, national government have the power to make changes along these lines, we could see a different set of outcomes. So that might be part of, you know, what some people would advocate if they think this particular system is kind of crazy.
Kathleen, thank you so much for spending the hour with us. It's been a real pleasure.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Kathleen Dolan is professor of in the Department of Political Science at the UW-Milwaukee. And thanks to Tom Jantek as well. Tom, thanks.
It's been my pleasure.
We'll look forward to talking with you again. Tom Jantek is associate professor and director of undergraduate studies in the Department of Political Science at Kent State University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing on air as well as off air today. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.